Well, I'm Corwin Smith, the director of the Paul B. Henry Institute for the Study of Christianity and Politics here at Kelvin College, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to today's event, the second annual Rule of Law Lecture. This annual lecture has been established in honor of Emeritus Professor Don Preuss, who taught in the Kelvin Department of Kelvin Department of Business and Economics. Don is with us here today, and we're happy that this lecture has been established to address issues related to the rule of law, a quality of life that enables businesses to function and humans to thrive. Don, would you please just stand a minute that we can acknowledge you? And I also want to acknowledge the donors of this rule of law lecture, Ed and Ruth Zylstra, and if you would just stand a minute, too. Today's lecture will be given by Dr. Kevin Dendall, currently the William Spoolhoff Teacher Scholar in Residence here at Kelvin College. Professor Dendall is a graduate of Kelvin College. He received his MA in Political Science from the University of Georgia and his PhD in Political Science from the University of Wisconsin. After receiving his PhD, Professor Dendall joined the Department of Political Science at Grand Valley State University, where he has taught until this past year. Dr. Dendall is an accomplished scholar and an excellent teacher. He's already won 3 awards for excellence in teaching, including 1 as a graduate student at the University of Wisconsin and 2 at Grand Valley State University. He's also the co-author of 3 books on religion and American politics, as well as the author of a number of chapters and journal articles on topics related to religion and the courts, as well as religion and American foreign policy. Related to both his interest in religion and the courts, as well as his interest in religion and foreign policy, Professor Dendall spent 3 weeks this past summer in China participating in an international seminar on religion, society, and the rule of law, sponsored by the Council of Christian Colleges and Universities. As part of that seminar, Professor Dendall was one of 8 North American scholars who joined 12 Chinese scholars in examining the rule of law in China. As an outgrowth of that work, he co-authored a forthcoming article entitled "The Rule of Law and Religion, American Perspectives and Chinese Experience." Today's talk reflects aspects of Professor Dendall's interest in both religion and politics and religion and American foreign policy as he addresses the topic, Fostering Religious Freedom in China, Are Property Rights the Key? And before I ask him to come to the podium, I should note that Professor Dendall has recently been appointed as the new director of the Henry Institute beginning in the next academic year. So please join with me in welcoming Dr. Kevin Dendall to our podium today.
All right. Well, first of all, let me thank again the namesake of the lecture series and the supporters of the lecture series. I had a very fine time having a chat with Professor Preuss last week over coffee. I know he's got a very significant passion and interest in rule of law. I hope I can do that justice. But I do want to start with a little self-deprecation. And I think one way to do that maybe is to, I don't think he's going to be embarrassed about this, but to point out Kelly Clark here in the audience, globe-trotting professor of philosophy here at Calvin. But I'm pointing him out because last year I was chatting with him about his travels, now several dozen times, maybe more, to China. He suggested, I know less at this point about China than I did when I started. And I thought, that gives me a little bit of confidence because I had been asked to give this lecture, and I thought, I've been to China now precisely 1 time. And if I follow by some strange logic the line of reasoning here, then maybe that means that I know more than I think I did. But I think what you will find is that if I tried to fake that, you would realize that I'm not a China scholar. I'm overwhelmed by Chinese history, totally blown away by it. I am baffled by Chinese political institutions. I know precious little of Chinese geography. I know even less of languages in China, in the plural, of course. And so I won't act as if I'm a China scholar, but where I have done a lot of work and where I have a lot of interest is in a question having to do with rights. What does it mean to assert rights? What does it mean to try to attain rights? I've looked at that question in the United States. I've looked at it comparatively in other places. I'm just starting to try to get my brain around what that looks like in Asia. So in some ways, my talk this afternoon is trying to apply some of the lessons that have been learned in other comparative contexts to what's happening in China. So that's just a little self-deprecation, so you all know. Still, I have to talk a little bit about China, of course, in a lecture like this. So the primary topic of my lecture is fostering religious freedom in China. And that assumes that religious freedom is something that needs to be fostered. And it perhaps implies that there's a problem with religious freedom in China. My goal in the talk is to really spend less time on the problem and defining the problem of religious freedom than how the problem might be addressed. Still, I have to say something about how I perceive the problem. I don't know if I have any students in the class, but I'm of course constantly telling them if we're going to address problems, we have to go through a process of problem definition. So I better do that and talk a little bit about how I see the problem in China's case. My very short answer is that I see the problem as having something to do with the rule of law, which is a good thing, given that I'm giving a lecture on the rule of law. But let me offer a slightly longer response than that. The problem may seem obvious, even if we limit ourselves to historical, limit our horizons, historical horizons to the post-Mao era. Just in the last decade and a half, we see many examples of direct state action against spiritual movements, religious traditions of various sorts in China, Muslims and Buddhists in the West, unregistered Christian churches in large urban areas in the East and South, nationwide phenomenon such as the Falun Gong. Sometimes government actions have been against religion in the form of local officials harassing a religious group over worship space, this or that religious practice, sometimes, but without actually disbanding that religious group. In other cases, government has resorted to crackdowns, outright eradication efforts. But taken together, these examples have led nearly every major civil liberties organization in the West to place China near the bottom of global religious freedom rankings, and even the U.S. State Department. And this is interesting in lots of ways. Despite obvious foreign policy sensitivities, much to the chagrin of Chinese officials, has formally designated China as a, quote, country of particular concern under the reporting requirements of the individual of the International Religious Freedom Act. This is interesting in lots of ways because, to my knowledge, this is the only domestic governmental agency in the world that is tasked with coming up with a ranking or to make some determinations about religious freedom. So our State Department is required to do that by law. And that designation, it's been in place since 1999 when State issued its first religious freedom report. It's based on an assessment of a pattern. And I want to emphasize this language of pattern of particularly severe violations of religious freedom. That's a quote. And to provide a little context, only seven other countries were given the same designation in 2010. Burma, Eritrea, Iran, North Korea, Saudi Arabia, Sudan, and Uzbekistan. So not, depending on your views, not happy company. But I want to back up because there's an important point here about patterns. After all, a pattern of governmental regulation of religion does not necessarily amount to a religious freedom problem. Consider that countries that we typically think of as having strong protections for religious freedom routinely place restrictions on religion. Few people find it problematic that local governments would place health and safety requirements on houses of worship, or that if a religionist claims for sincere religious reasons that he or she doesn't want to pay taxes, that the government might still come after them for taxes, right? Or that if somebody does violence in the name of religion, that government can, you know, prosecute. These we generally don't view as problems. But government does that routinely. It places restrictions on those religious practices. So it isn't simply that it's a pattern. There are, of course, more controversial examples, but the basic point here is the principle. Religious freedom does not mean that the state is forbidden absolutely from regulating religious practice. So what is it about the recent patterns? Let's see if I get this. There we go. What is it about the recent patterns of regulation and restriction in China that suggest a religious freedom problem? A clue, I would argue, is in the groups the Chinese government has recently sought to suppress, those Muslims and Buddhists and Falun Gong, unregistered churches in Beijing and elsewhere. In each instance, these are groups with grievances, with numbers, and with ready-made organization. And when you say those three things together to a political scientist, they hear hear basically conditions for political mobilization, right? These are all resources in some ways for political mobilization. But of course, China is a one-party state. Greatest fear of one-party states is competition. That is effective political mobilization by oppositional groups. The party has generally tried to address this fear through co-optation by tolerating certain religious traditions under the framework of officially sanctioned and monitored patriotic religious associations. And I won't get into all of that here. Many of you know about those associations. But when groups fall outside of this legal framework, and particularly when they get large and when they get well-organized and aggrieved and a little uppity, they pose a political management problem in a one-party state. To see how that becomes a religious freedom problem, switch vantage points from a party to a person. Let's imagine, for example, a pastor in an unregistered church in Beijing, one of those so-called house churches that refuses to affiliate with these patriotic associations. The pastor knows that local officials and party leaders in Beijing have, in effect, looked the other way when most unregistered churches worship in the city. But there are those gnawing counter examples, those exceptions, those times when police have shut down a church, hauled its leaders away. Those actions, state actions, may seem arbitrary to that pastor. The pastor has no reasonable way of predicting when the state might take similar action against his or her own church, what formal legal recourse he or she might have if the state did take action. In this environment of constant doubt, the pastor would sense little freedom. And so in other words, the pastor's freedom, this is a somewhat more technical way of putting it, I suppose, pastor's freedom is violated by a lack of rule of law. And this is a key dimension of this. The pastor can't consult a set of relatively fixed, enforceable, transparent rules. We typically think of those as characteristics of the rule of law that lends some predictability and clarity to his or her church's status. Instead, the church's fate is tied to the rule of persons, or the rule of will, as it's sometimes put. The pastor has to rely on guesses about the interests and actions of local officials or party leaders. The rule of law assumes that certain rules transcend the specific interests of those rulers, that as we sometimes put it, no one is above the law. The rule of persons assumes that the ruler's interests, in a sense, are the law, which invites arbitrary rule and even tyranny. And so that's a key component of the religious freedom problem in China as I see it. But is that all that ought to be expected of the rule of law, that the pastor would be able to see and apply the rules that apply to him or her, and know that he or she will be treated similarly to everyone else under those rules? There's an entire, actually, one scholar puts this as a rule of law industry, one scholar of China, a rule of law industry tries to address that question. Where do we go with the rule of law? What does it mean, especially in practice? Some insist, and there's a couple of ways of looking at this, sometimes the distinction is made between the thin and the thick forms of rule of law. Well, some insist that China's unique history calls for a thin view of the rule of law. That is, an emphasis on greater, and here's some examples of what that would look like, of greater uniformity, consistency in application of rules, publicity, meaning transparency of the law, that you could actually look it up, find out how it applies to you. These are the important aspects of the rule of law, but this is a thin view. It suggests very little about basic governmental structures or let's say fundamental ways that government might act. A state can have these thin components of the rule of law, for example, and reject a plebiscite democracy. You could have this without necessarily having democracy in ways that we understand it. Nor does this thin view suggest that citizens have fundamental freedoms beyond some basic due process rights. Hence, citizens might be free to plan their lives under the rules. Right? I know the rules. I can plan my life. There's predictability as a result of knowing what the rules are. So they're free to plan their lives, but the rules themselves might forbid them from doing things they may wish to do, including something as fundamentally important as practicing their faith as they see fit. So others argue that China, like any other country, must adopt a thick view, there it is, a thick vision of the rule of law. And for my purposes, there's different things we could talk about here. Institutional checks, you often hear in this thick view the argument that there has to be some form of checks among different institutions within government that can take lots of different forms, but it has to exist in some way. But for my purposes, I want to talk about these substantive rights. For my purposes this afternoon, the key idea in this thick vision of rule of law is that individual rights and the rule of law are inextricable. A person's ability to assert both due process and substantive rights, religion, right to practice religion, provides a check on government that ensures that rulers are not above the law. You might detect in that way of talking certain hints of things like classical liberal theory, with its emphasis on individual rights rooted in nature or social contract or utilitarian calculation. There are different ways that those rights are rooted. But this assumption is also consistent with more modern notions of human rights. It is liberty claims that individuals can make against the state by virtue of their basic dignity. Of an individual's basic dignity. So I want you to assume with me, just for sake of argument for a little while, we can argue about it later, just for sake of argument, that the goal really ought to be this thicker vision of the rule of law, and that a very broad understanding of religious freedom would be included in that vision. So my next question is, what would it take to see that kind of vision put into practice in China? So now the problem definition is over. What do you do to try to address it? Well, one way of doing this is by, or one strategy really, a political strategy, is to enshrine a right that the Chinese Communist Party, in this instance in China, has an incentive to foster, and then hope that that right has radiating effects. Or to put that differently, that because you have a right in one area, you might have stronger protections for rights in another. And possibly the most plausible suspect or prospect here is the right to property. Consider, for example, that China now, for the last three decades, has been trying to adapt, as we all know, to the complexities of globalization, market-based economics. Leaders in the party during that process have been under intense pressure, both at home and internationally, to toughen protections for intellectual and other types of property. The argument is, well, in order for China to become this major economic power and trading partner and so forth, it needs to develop a rule of law that protects property rights. Now, for many human rights activists, this discussion about property rights has been very encouraging because they see positive reform to property rights signaling the possibility of greater protections for additional rights as well. And they can point to other national contexts where, in fact, that kind of rule of law reform has been contagious. In other words, where you have property rights in one area and it leads ultimately to rights in others. You can find those examples all over the place. You could actually, you could argue about whether it happened in the United States. You could, but even in China's neighborhood, you could make some arguments about Taiwan or South Korea. Why might property rights have this effect? I haven't been moving this along. So here we go. So here are some reasons why property rights might have an effect of this kind of radiating effect. Some argue, for example, that markets serve as a counterbalance to government, to political power. Others operate something like civil society. I'm going to talk about civil society in a little bit. Others suggest that markets are seedbeds for certain skills that matter, certain civic resources, skills of leadership and communication, dispositions of independence or initiative. And the argument is that these sorts of things naturally blossom into a desire for other basic freedoms. So you sometimes hear that kind of argument. But perhaps the most important argument, I don't know if schoolmaster is the right word here, but the most important argument is that markets teach, or property rights, teach a respect for rule of law. Markets simply don't function properly without rules of the game that are public, relatively clear, enforced neutrally. It's hard to imagine gaining the productive advantages of markets without rule of law governing matters such as contractual rights or right to reasonable returns on investments. So this is one way of doing, strategy of doing it. Start with one right, move to another. Well, amid these kinds of hopeful arguments, I think there are reasons for caution when we look at this cross-nationally, when we look at what are sometimes referred to as rights revolutions in other countries. So I want to move on to that. Oh, a little props on a rights revolution. So a definition of a rights revolution, it's a dynamic, multifaceted process. It's really a process, not usually one, one-time deal. It can happen over 100 years, a rights revolution. But as political scientists use the term, it's this dynamic, multifaceted process that ultimately results in a recognition and implementation, protection of rights that weren't protected before, that didn't exist in some instances before. And so the question is, how do we end up with a rights revolution? How do we get from point A to point B over time? And political scientists have been looking at this, and others have been looking at these questions, and have argued that essentially rights revolutions do have patterns, systematic patterns that we can find, but their preconditions are not necessarily economic, and indeed what we often perceive as the effects of, say, protections for property rights or economic liberalization is really more strongly connected to these other preconditions. So what are these other preconditions? Well, here's a model, and I'll roll through these fairly quickly first here. It's a model that suggests that there are three basic components. One is an institutional component that that state institutions themselves have to be amenable to a rights revolution. There are ways that that happens. But also that the political culture, that the public as a whole begins to understand itself, that citizens begin to understand themselves as rights bearers. And then finally, that civil society has a role to play in bridging, in a sense, the institutional and the cultural. So let me talk about each of those in turn and then apply it to China. Let's start with institutions. The tendency here is to think about courts and constitutions, right? That courts are playing a role in the immediate wake of World War II. For example, most Western European states established new constitutions. Those constitutions were full of new rights, and they established new constitutional courts as so-called guardians. That's the way they were talked about at the time and still are in some places, as guardians of those constitutions and of those rights. Most post-communist states in Eastern Europe followed suit in the 1990s, as did some post-colonial states in sub-Saharan Africa and Latin America. These trends reflected what scholars sometimes call the globalization of judicial review. That is, the power of high courts to review actions of other political institutions and usually to determine the constitutionality of those actions. That becomes a global trend in the post-war era. An important characteristic buttresses judicial review, and that's independence, the independence of these courts. If a court has authority to review the constitutionality of the actions of other branches, one would assume that it is independent, right? Independent of pressure from those other bodies, from those other institutions. And as it turns out, judicial independence is a pretty good predictor of whether new rights have taken hold in countries around the world. Now, it's not the only predictor, and actually I'm gonna zip past this. Don't look. You can look, but maybe I'll talk about that. Talk about that in a little bit. There are other ways that institutions might play a role than just judicial independence, but that's a primary way. All right, so it's important to say, well, we've got courts, institutions, amenable institutions that are part of rights revolutions. But it's also important to note that this judicial approach doesn't really work without a culture that supports it. And so this is that second component of rights revolutions. Courts don't hear rights claims unless people assert those claims. It's a simple point. The point is that states that protect rights are generally responding to citizens that mobilize around rights. And this really points us toward a factor that goes beyond institutions. It matters that you have a broad-based culture that accepts the basic elements of a thick vision of the rule of law. We have numerous examples of reform movements that begin with the process of what's sometimes referred to as legal mobilization, translating a grievance into a claim against government, but that claim coming against government in the form of a right. So legal mobilization usually activates people based on their grievances, but then translates those into rights claims. The model case is the civil rights era in the United States, capitalized on broad-based activism to move both Congress and the courts to act. But we can find all sorts of other examples around the globe of that sort of action from Europe, Latin America, and so forth. The basic process of legal mobilization entails a group of people moving from grievances to claiming their rights. In the context of religious freedom, for example, one can imagine an endless array of grievances that religious believers might have against government. But these grievances by themselves are not the basis for legal mobilization. After all, some religionists might say, you know, I have a grievance, but I'm going to bear it. I'm not going to contest it. I'm not going to go to government and say, I have a grievance, please deal with it. Other religionists might decide to contest that grievance, to bring it to the forefront, but through extra legal means, one example being terrorism. In contrast, legal mobilization requires that the aggrieved perceive their circumstances as a violation of a legal right, and that they use legal processes at their disposal to assert that right against government. scholars, sociolegal scholars, called the mechanism here for moving from a grievance to a rights consciousness. It sounds slightly Marxist, but it isn't. So the role of rights consciousness, and this is a basic process where people begin to understand their interactions, their social interactions, political interactions, economic interactions, in terms of rights. I relate to you in terms of the rights that I have. Okay, that's rights consciousness. And scholars find over and over that rights consciousness on a mass scale is almost always a precursor to a rights revolution. So now we have two preconditions of a rights revolution that scholars tend to identify: elite institutions, mass-based culture that support mobilization around rights. But these two factors together are still insufficient to explain the rights revolution around the world. Think about it in terms of their agenda. Courts are generally pretty passive. They're tasked with settling disputes that come before them. And so their agenda is limited by those disputes. Ordinary citizens, when they perceive that their rights have been violated, may be uncertain about how to address their rights claims, especially when faced with complex judicial systems, right? How do I negotiate this judicial system? This suggests that legal reform requires a bridge of some kind between institutions and rights claims of ordinary citizens. And comparative work on rights revolutions will generally call this a support structure. A kind of bridge between individuals and the state. And that support structure is basically built by lawyers and their professional associations. If we think about this, I worked on that. I'm so proud of this. You ready? So here's a smiley face. This is an individual operating out there in the world, abstractly. There's the state, and that felt pretty solid to me, so that's the graphic. But now when you think about this very simple model, if an individual is interacting directly with the state, they're at a significant disadvantage, right? So the typical model, there are other ways of thinking about civil society, but a typical model of thinking about civil society, and you ready for it, is that it sits right in between the individual and the state. It serves this kind of mediator role, okay? And all those circles represent different types of associations that we might belong to within civil society, but those associations taken together fill perform this kind of bridging function and allow us and put something between us and the state. Well, we can think about in the United States, one of the bigger circles there would be religion. There'd be lots of other things, labor unions. So you could talk about lots of different associations. But one of the key, it took me forever to figure out even how to do that, but key circle are lawyers, right? Lawyers and professional associations associated with lawyers. So they perform this role. We sometimes take that for granted, but they are performing this role in civil society. And what's especially important when we think about rights claims that people might make is that there's a specific kind of category of lawyers who are fixated on defending these rights claims. And what scholars sometimes call those lawyers are cause lawyers. They are lawyers that are not necessarily focused on representing clients, but clients are a means to representing a cause. And there's an entire literature on this, and this is where much of my writing has been, actually, on cause lawyers for religious organizations, especially in the United States. But those cause lawyers play this significant role in civil society. All right. So we have a model here that includes the state, amenable state institutions, political culture, and civil society operating. Here's the model revisited. So if that's our model, what are the prospects for China if we were to apply this? Well, we could start with institutions, and the Chinese constitution does declare protections for religious belief and, quote, normal religious activity. As it stands, however, no Chinese court has authority to invalidate governmental actions under the Constitution. The power of constitutional interpretation, such as it is, rests with the Standing Committee of the National People's Congress, the very same body that has plenary legislative power when the full MPC is not in session. At the highest level, then, the legislative and judicial powers are not separate, and courts are therefore not independent. So one of those conditions that we talked about earlier. And not that it matters much to religious freedom anyway, because ordinary citizens have no formal avenue to petition courts over constitutional matters. So that's a significant problem. If we look forward, the Standing Committee has little incentive to change this kind of arrangement. Even if the party is motivated to strengthen courts to enforce property rights, there's no necessary reason to believe they'd extend a court's jurisdiction to other rights. And besides, the best sort of economic work really done on incentives in this context suggests that authoritarian regimes are most likely to strengthen judicial independence when rulers see democratization as inevitable. The Democrats are coming, and so we're going to create independent courts. And the reason is that parties will suspect that if they lose office, they can use the courts as a way to protect themselves, as a form of political insurance, to protect against unhindered opposition rule. But we see little evidence of that fundamental shift in China, at least in the near term. Now, this emphasis on the Chinese constitution, constitutional courts, party competition, all that sort of thing, is maybe too focused on centralized power in Beijing. But after all, you know, China is this enormous, far-flung country where much of the work of governing is happening at local and provincial levels. So could it be that reform will come from institutions at the bottom rather than the top? That's impossible for a China neophyte like me to predict. But I would note that most religious believers who run afoul of the state find themselves in local criminal courts under so-called administrative detention by local officials. It usually happens under the charge of, quote, inciting subversion of state power, which can and has included a host of religious activities that are viewed as a threat to that paramount Chinese value of social harmony. And the Chinese criminal justice system at the local and provincial levels is entirely weighted toward the government, with very few robust due process rights available to defendants. And indeed, the litigation process, which is often adversarial, in fact, by definition in Anglo-American context, it is adversarial, is itself a threat to harmony, which explains why few criminal cases are actually litigated. This is, by the way, unlike that developing area of property rights in China, which often pits private citizens or groups against each other, right, rather than citizens against the state's authority. So in that context, the state is a little more open to a little more conflict, legal conflict. So these obstacles in elite institutions are also reflected in the mass population's attitude about legal mobilization, and especially the idea of translating their grievances, and they've got those, but translating those grievances into rights claims. Scholars are just beginning to look at legal mobilization in China. My reading of preliminary evidence suggests there are really stiff headwinds here. Citizens traditionally have little concept of legal rights, at least as Westerners would understand the term. To the extent it has meaning, that rights have meaning, most citizens seem to perceive a legal right as a reflection of individual self-interest, which is at odds with that value of social harmony. And asserting a right in a legal process butts up against two walls, really. One is cultural, the other political. Culturally, an adversarial approach in the courts through litigation is culturally dissonant. People are accustomed to resolving conflict through things like informal mediation or even just avoidance. But politically, there is a well-founded belief that legal proceedings are subject to political interference. And so there's a perception that law doesn't really reflect justice anyway, right? So those are some problems in political culture. But perhaps these perceptions are changing. And if they are changing, it's very clear to me that lawyers are going to have a central role to play in those changes. And here's where I'm going to spend a little slightly more time thinking about the role of lawyers. They face some key challenges. One challenge is simply capacity. To put it simply, and this is going to sound, maybe it's going to sound strange, but there are too few lawyers in China. There just aren't enough of them. It's not surprising lawyering was effectively banned during the Cultural Revolution. And in the economic reforms of the 1980s, the party recognized a need for lawyers. And so you started to see some growth in lawyering in the country. But that still means that China has had little more than 30 years to rebuild its legal profession, right? So a little bit of time. Its efforts have been impressive, right? We've seen it in the, we've seen impressive results in the economic context. Same thing has been in the proliferation of lawyers. So coming out of the Cultural Revolution, the best estimates I've seen put the number of lawyers at about 3,000. Today, those estimates range to as high as a couple hundred thousand. And that's significant change. And in that same period of time, independent firms, law firms, have been proliferating. In China. Most are focused on commercial activity, but there are a few of them that are focused on human rights kinds of considerations, including religious freedom. And so these are heartening signs of organized mobilization in some ways. But in comparison, comparative perspective, the lawyer rate really remains a pittance. And this just gives you one representation of that. So this is just showing you the number of attorneys per 100,000 residents in selected countries. And these are largely the results from bar associations in each of these countries. There's a lot of variation here. You've got to take this with a grain of salt, because in some instances, you've got lawyers who are practicing without a kind of professional credential, and the credentialing is very different across countries and so forth. But I think it still gives a pretty good sense of what we're looking at. China has 14 lawyers per 100,000 residents. And for perspective, that number is 79 in Singapore, 102 in India, 187 in Germany, 319 in Brazil, just shy of 400 in the U.S. And I'm not holding that number up as a model necessarily, the U.S. number. But just looking at this comparatively, you can see that there is a problem, really, with capacity. And the profession continues to struggle a great deal with competence, problems of competence. And so without more and better lawyers, Chinese civil society, if lawyers matter to civil society, has a long way to go. But there's a second challenge, a long way to go if it's going to mediate between the individual and the state. But the second challenge, really, is the state itself. I mentioned a moment ago, I don't know if I actually mentioned this, the party opened the door in 1996 to those independent firms, law firms. And so you started to see more and more of these firms coming on the scene. But in subsequent years, the party leadership has not looked kindly on these efforts. Groups, and especially rights-based groups. This is particularly clear. Here's a challenge of the state. Particularly clear in a couple of examples, the Weishan movement, which is literally this a kind of rights-defending movement in the early 2000s, group of loosely networked lawyers who spearheaded that movement. In response, you had the party doing a number of things to sort of retrench along what is sometimes they sometimes refer to as a socialist concept of the rule of law. What that meant in practice, the standing committee said in 2006 that forceful measures had to be taken against these lawyers in the movement, including and what happened is that a lot of lawyers, as a result, were imprisoned, disbarred, disappeared, and or tortured. And there were a lot of institutional decisions made by the party during that time, including putting
really ideologues, not so much lawyers, but ideologues in charge of some of the courts and so forth. So that was a response to efforts of lawyers, a response by the state to these efforts by lawyers to engage in rights advocacy. Now, you might say, well, perhaps then you look outside of China. Maybe you can look for a support structure within organizations outside the country. And you can maybe consider the phenomenon here of transnational legal activism. Those Activists Without Borders is a very good book with that title, who combine international legal norms with indigenous rights-based movements. Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, in some ways, are prominent examples of these transnational networks. And it's very interesting, and we don't have time to talk about it right now. Maybe we could talk about it in question and answer. But these transnational networks have everything to do with, movements in globalization and so forth. So it's interesting to think about how these groups might play a role. But scholars have noted that China has been particularly resistant to these groups' primary tactics, providing information to folks on the ground, using powerful institutions to apply pressure, the WTO or U.S. foreign policy and so forth. China has resisted that. It's in some ways an exception, has been an exception to a general rule where these transnational activists have been really quite effective. So, you've got these different challenges within civil society itself, and especially to lawyers. So where does this leave us? Well, in some ways, in the near term, when I look at this, the prospects for a rights revolution in China, especially one that protects religious freedom, are mixed at best. On the one hand, party controlled. Institutions are resistant. Mass public is generally not attuned to the notion of a kind of thick idea of rule of law. Legal profession is small, hampered up and down the system. On the other hand, there's clearly more openness in the post-Mao era. There are some pockets of citizens who have developed something like a rights consciousness, at least as best I can tell. And there is a growing legal profession and a culture of activism. So in light of this model, one thing that I've started thinking about a little bit is, what is our response in the West? How do we look at that? First, and this is just an assertion, earlier I said, let's just play along here. Let's just assume that we should have a thick vision of the rule of law. Well, I just assert that we should hold up a thick vision of the rule of law in China as a compelling goal. But at the same time, we should acknowledge the means of achieving that goal represent profound and complex challenges. For Westerners concerned about basic rights and particularly religious freedom, it's tempting to seek a silver bullet. Leveraging property rights and open markets has been a tactic in this regard. So some prominent Christian voices, for example, have insisted that the United States link normal trade relations to the Chinese government's treatment of religion. Others have suggested that such punitive measures are irrelevant because China's economic codependence with the U.S. will inevitably lead China to embrace property rights, and other rights will inevitably follow. But I would suggest that the path to rule of law is not that straightforward. If cross-national comparisons are any guide, the path would require a complex mix of institutional and cultural change fostered by a robust civil society. And that suggests policy tactics that are more developmental than real politique. The patient building of capacity among Chinese citizens so that they can craft their own version of a rights revolution. I'll end there and take any questions or comments. Wow, I get off easy. No.
I haven't been in China in a few years, but spent just a little bit of time, so I'm a novice, not an expert, but you're talking about the opening of private law firms.
Yeah.
I was there in 1996,
and yeah.
A person in the circle of conversation is identified as the person who opened the first private law firm. And what was interesting about that was that he had actually he was Chinese in origin, had come to law school in the West, had practiced contract law in the West, and when China changed the law, he made a conscious decision to go back to Beijing and open the first private law firm because he could see the curve coming in terms of global economic contractual opportunities that he would be positioned to work on.
Yeah.
And so one of my questions that comes out of that is, might the growth and the demand and the need for lawyers in China be fueled by the fact that they see themselves as such a rising global economic power, and to be able to negotiate their economic transactions, particularly in the West, they have to have legal expertise. Case in point, Chinese company bought an automotive steering company in Saginaw, Michigan, not too long ago, and they have got to be able to negotiate the purchase transactions, the understanding of employee rights, with full knowledge of U.S. context, but from a Chinese angle.
Yeah.
So what do you see there?
Well, I mean, I think the party itself has been very clear that they need that legal expertise. There's been, for example, the development of something like, I think, over 500 law schools now in China, from essentially none during the Cultural Revolution. And you know, so that in itself, and of course the party is pushing that, that in itself suggests a very strong interest in starting to train attorneys to deal with what it means to operate in a global economic setting. But my question here is, even if there is this push to have a larger and more competent legal profession, is that going to have an impact on rights advocacy when it comes to religious freedom? And that's a different matter. Now, it may happen in creative ways. It's interesting. I did have a, even though I've only been there once, it was a very intense couple of weeks in China. And I did a fair amount of interviewing, and I interviewed one attorney, young woman who went to law school in the United States, was keenly interested in religious freedom, and that was really her main goal, was to deal with disputes and cases, religious freedom claims that people would make in China. And she was doing those kinds of things in very nitty-gritty ways. It wasn't, hey, I'm going to, you know, bring a constitutional claim. She couldn't, right? But she was doing some really basic stuff on a local level. But she supported herself, and in fact, I would say probably 75% of her work was corporate. She was doing a variety of contractual, you know, economic contractual, doing a lot of work with economic contracts and so forth as a way to support this effort when it comes to religious freedom, which she was doing on the side but was really her first love. So when I think about prospects in the future, that I keep coming back to that story. It's just an anecdote. I mean, to be careful not to generalize from it, but it strikes me that what she was doing was saying, I've developed this skill set in one setting when it comes to property rights and so forth, and it's something that both supports me financially, but it also has given me an expertise that I can bring to bear in this other setting, and very carefully, but I can do this in this other setting. And so, you know, perhaps that kind of thing will develop more and more, but when you look at this rights defending movement and so forth that happened,
it's too public.
It's too public.
It's too public.
It got crushed for that reason.
Legal strategies are going to have to be a lot more subtle.
Yeah, that's exactly what she's doing. It's very subtle work. You know what she does essentially is goes around and talks with leaders in the unregistered churches and says, here's what you do when the police come knocking on your door. And in fact, most of the time she's saying to them, don't call me, right? Because then I'm essentially out. But here's what you can do. Here's your recourse. So she does a lot of this kind of training of people. And, you know, that from the vantage point of, you know, what I was saying about rights consciousness, in some ways she's building this rights consciousness among religious elites that are operating in Beijing.
Undergrad degree. So do you think this kind of like caused lawyer? Because both of the anecdotes have been people who studied in the West.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think that this will be a Western imported thing? Or do you think that like the Chinese law schools are set up and the students attending there are going to be people who are interested in kind of cause lawyer?
Yeah. I don't know as much about the practices at those law schools to really, really well to the question, but it is a case. You know, if you think about transnational networks, a lot of the religious freedom advocacy that's being done in China is by Chinese lawyers, who were trained in the West or have support from the West in some other way. That exposes them in some other ways that can be problematic. But this, you know, this attorney would never tell anybody where she went to law school, and you know, in some ways she talked about the economic work that she did as a cover, right? So there's still that care that they take. Yeah.
See payoff to property rights and development of markets. I mean, you do that because it develops the economy. There are pragmatic benefits from that. You get economic development, economic growth. The payoff to granting rights to religious organizations seems to be nothing but trouble. I mean, religion is just creates trouble.
Yeah.
And certainly that's been the Chinese attitude, as far as I can tell, the government's attitude toward religion up to this point. So I guess I don't see how that transference takes place between, oh, well, we have rights in this area, so we can have rights in that area, too.
We agree. I mean, essentially what I'm arguing here is that there are these preconditions to making claims of rights that have to be in place before you can make them. And so that it doesn't work just to say, well, if we have property rights here, we're going to be okay over there. You have to have state institutions. You have to have massive cultural change, all these things that take a lot of time. That's why, you know, the last sentence of my talk is patience, right? These things take a lot of time. Now, one thing, I think an inclination is to see the response of the party to religion in old-style ideological terms. You're not doing that, but I think a lot of people still think about it in those terms, that this is, you know, communists going after the opiate of the masses. There's some interesting research that's been done by a sociologist at Purdue who looks at the role that kind of ideology might play within the party, and argues that it still does play a role among people, especially the folks who are charged with sort of overseeing the monitoring of religion in the country. But for most members of the party, religion is like any other form of social organization that might become a problem for them in their own desire to maintain their power. And so I agree with you that, you know, religion is viewed as a problem as long as it's outside of the framework that they can control, but maybe not for those Marxist ideological reasons. Yeah, John.
I'm a Chinese, native Chinese.
By the way, can I just say, we spent 2 weeks together in China. John was with me in China, and we were roommates the first week, and he easily, and I'm not just saying this just because he's here, but he easily taught me the most about China of everyone. So that doesn't explain all my mistakes.
Yeah, but not some seminarian in coming college. carbon scenery, just as rare as panda from China. The only one.
Yeah.
In concept.
Yeah.
Scenery. Professor Dandock gave us a very profound analysis of check and balance of the property and human rights. So I think it is a good way. I'm not an expert in public area, but I do some research into religious study. I have a PhD degree in religious study and church leader of unregistered church. So I got some understanding of that. I just want to say something from my own perspective so that you can understand a little better of Chinese religious rights present. And one of my professors ever given a lecture, he just make an analogy. That is Chinese government has a neurocancer. Why is it saying so? Because the Chinese system usually, because Professor Daniel Bess knows this, they are very pay too much attention to one's relationship. So this is due to the Chinese long mentality. And at the very beginning, it is a consanguineous, patriarchal system. And later, it is a totalitarian, patriarchal system. So there is no individual personality, but projected common personality and taken by the government officials, especially the highest one. So people take that as an ideal personality, and all people say it is good. But sometimes he tried to act as or show up as ideal personality by trying to comfort the other people. In one way, to give some spoils to the feelings or attachment followers. So usually they will use the Confucianism at Oxford, as show up. But inwardly, they use legalism. Oxford Confucianism, just a relationship, ethics. But internally, that is legalism, check and balance. So Professor Dandock just mentioned market or just economic companies, or as they grow up, they can become a check and balance of the government or poor. It is a good way. The government will never give you actively some rights. You have to seek that by yourself. So that is a check and balance. Since this mentality, the Chinese government always take other religions as a threat to the governmental powers, because sometimes they have their own ideology, their own belief. They don't want to readily submissive to the government. So the government take that as a threat. So the government take every kind of method to control that. Just now Professor Dandock also mentioned that. The patriotic organizations, in religious, in Christianity, they have three self, hedgehog, committee. And that is a political organization. We ever visited their headquarters. There is a non three self committee at the first level. And then the Chinese Christian, Christian Church Council. So the political organization or government is always taken as a head of that. So if you never belong, you never submissive, or just adjust your theology to that, you will always be taken as a threat. Nowadays, there are some law firms. They try to balance. They try to secure the property, the human rights. But it is really so hard for them. They can be bought. They can be bought. I give you money. You have to earn money, but I give you money. Please speak for me, okay? But the only way for them to stay stably is those Christian lawyers. They have been beaten, they have been tortured, they have been persecuted, but they persisted. There are some still in the prison, still fighting for human rights. So notice the only way for them to persist, not only in religious field, but also in some other field, there must be some firms or companies to support them. Otherwise, they will be easily bought out. So that is my understanding. Okay.
Yeah, from personal experience. Thanks. I knew when you showed up, I should just have you come up. But one of the things, one thing that I didn't talk about, but that is very much part of civil society, is the extent to which you've got religious groups of various sorts, not just associated with patriotic associations, operating in the country. Mm-hmm. And they become themselves a very robust, vibrant part of civil society. In fact, sometimes talk about themselves as part of civil society. And that was very much my experience of the unregistered churches in Beijing, which I got introduced to in lots of fascinating ways through John during my time in here. So thanks. And One thing that, as a social scientist, we had lots of deep theological discussions. One thing as a social scientist that would be interesting to be able to do is to understand whether some of the perspectives that you were just describing, John, have an influence on the way people understand rights. Rights being things that individuals bear, right? Is it difficult in China to even make an argument for rights because they're perceived right away as individualistic? It doesn't fit into that long history of understanding yourself correctly.
Yeah, that's sort of where I was thinking with my brief question. I mean, again, you just were introduced to that. There is sort of the transference from religious discourse to sort of political discourse that sustains sort of individual rights claims, mm-hmm. in the middle part of the three criteria. Right. There's also, of course, biblical sources for that provide like cultural repertoires for liberation, for mm-hmm. example, sort of obviously Old Testament and New. What's your? I just don't know anything about Christianity in China, or very little anyway. Of course, Christianity sort of is ambivalent in that sense. They sort of have liberatory or non-liberatory messages. What's your sense of sort of the balance within the underground churches as well as the established mm-hmm. churches? Any sense of that?
There are certainly people in the room who are better able to answer that question about what
what's happening within the house churches and their understanding of theology. But I would say that that's one of the many reasons that the party perceives religion as a threat, because it might have these liberationist strains. And if those religious groups with those liberationist strains in their theology are not part of those patriotic associations that are closely monitored and maintained, then the state doesn't have control of it, and it then becomes this political management problem. But I'm not sure in looking at what social scientists have had to say about China that anyone knows the extent to which there are those underlying ways of thinking, and to what extent those might ultimately come up in the next couple of decades. And that actually just points to the difficulty, I think, of good social scientific work in China. There have been a lot of efforts at surveying and so forth, but we don't even really know how many religionists there are. The range of numbers that we see is significant. So we don't even know the numbers, let alone how everyone's thinking theologically in the country. A lot of anecdotes. Yeah.
You talk about property rights pretty generally,
yeah.
But it occurs to me that there are some types of property rights which seem to be advancing pretty readily in China, and other types of property rights not so much. I wonder if, for instance, you could get contract law and you could get some basic autonomy in the business world without leading to freedom of religion, but maybe something like a widespread adoption of intellectual property,
yeah,
kind of a stronger connection. And is there any sort of, can you tease out different types of property rights at all and find stronger relationships?
Yeah, I suppose you could. I haven't. But I suppose you could tease those out. And you could also look at things like land rights among groups, especially in rural areas, which has been on the certainly on the mind of the party. In fact, a couple of weeks ago, when the party met, there was a lot of discussion about land rights and that would be a legislative priority in the coming year for the People's Congress. And so, yeah, there are lots of different types of rights. I think part of the reason the party was responding to these concerns about land rights among the rural poor is that many of folks in rural areas were starting to agitate. We're in a sense starting to turn grievances into rights claims. And so whether, though, making a claim about land would then have some impact on making other sorts of claims, and whether that would be different than, say, contract right or labor right or whatever it happens to be, I haven't teased that out yet. This is a sketch of a theory.
Right.
Yeah, thanks.
Just one more question.
That's all right.
Thank you. Well, so let me see if I can package this into as succinct a chain as I can. I love the word radiative. Just think if Reaganomics had been characterized by radiative rather than trickle down.
Yeah.
You know, it would have been so much more palatable. But I think we have a tendency to always frame things around gradualistic change.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can say, you can contrast the degree of hard work that would have to be done to build religious freedom for its own sake versus a trickle-down effect or radiative effect from economic or property rights change. But there's a third alternative out there, which is a more quantum leap.
Mm-hmm.
When you talk to historians, you know, there are lots of stories about quantum leaps or, you know, major jumps. And I wonder if there are any keys out there. And actually, Steve's question made me think of another one, that your picture, you have civil society in the middle. But don't most of our stories from political science coming out of China talk about local government as sort of the major surrogate for civil society?
Yeah.
Is there a key there where, say, a local government could grant a church some sort of freedom and then defend that all the way to the national level on the grounds of some existing communist or Chinese argument about local autonomy? And could that be a key?
Yeah. Sort? So one thing that I did mention in the talk is local courts, right, where most of these disputes about religious practice and worship space and so forth, they end up in local courts. But one of the problems, again, is that religionists at a local level face all sorts of impediments to due process, and especially just local officials intruding themselves into the process and trumping what judges may want to do. Judges don't have an independence at that level. But the general point about local government being an aspect of civil society, I think is a perfectly appropriate circle to add to that amoeba-like thing. We can see that in lots of other places around the globe. We see it in the United States. I mean, that's how Tocqueville talked about civil society. Local government was part of that. And so you can imagine, and when you look at other countries, Poland comes to mind for some reason, but there you do have an instance where it isn't gradualist change, but it's almost a moment in time where civil society butts up against an authoritarian regime, and that regime comes down in part because of international pressure, but because there's a labor union and a church in civil society that pushes up against it. So there are those examples cross-nationally where the rights revolution was a little more along the lines of what we think of as a revolution. It's this moment in time where it happened and it was a dramatic change and you could see it very clearly from point A to point B. I just don't see in China from the little I've studied at this point how that kind of change can happen in a country as enormous and as globally interconnected as that. The Polish example just doesn't travel as well in the way I'm looking at it. But that's an interesting point about local government.
The analogy from the trickle-down side that I was thinking about is, there's so many countries that are leapfrogging, for instance, wire telecommunications going straight to cell phones.
Right.
China is a very high-tech country, becoming one. Are there keys that the West can turn that would rapidly build civil society capability, particularly in legal environments? I mean, you have here companies selling legal services where one lawyer can write contracts for hundreds of thousands of people.
Right.
Is there any analogy
in that? I'd have to think about that. It is interesting you mentioned technology. I mean, one of the reasons there was a recent crackdown on religious and other groups in China is precisely because of what was happening in the Middle East and the use of technology. And so restrictions placed on the use of that technology in China. I'm not technically astute enough to know whether Western countries are able to subvert that in various ways. But in any event, the Chinese party itself, or the Communist Party itself, seem to be deeply concerned about it. So maybe that's the clue. Right. What they become concerned about, maybe that's the coolness.
Let me say, there's some people that still want to ask some questions, but those of you that feel that you need to leave, feel free to do so. And we'll just continue the conversation for a little while longer, and then we'll call it to a close. But right now, before anybody else leaves, could we just thank Kevin for his presentation? I'll just let you go ahead and answer
sure.
In response to that gentleman's query, what great difficulty local Chinese churches have is that they're unconnected with a church across town, let alone a church in another district, and the government is really dividing and conquering here and deliberately doing that, so that at the moment there's no way for someone who's a Christian in Beijing, for example, to easily attend a church in Shanghai without some kind of personal relationship with somebody going there and being taken there. That kind of freedom that we just assume in the West to drop into any church whatsoever does not exist in China. So without that, I don't see how you're gonna build from the bottom up. And I think the Chinese government is rather determined to keep these groups small and unconnected.
Well, you can with the registered churches.
With the registered.
You can, but not with the house groups.
Though. Yeah. And by the way, precisely that same phenomenon happens with lawyers. Dispersed, disconnected, not highly networked, That seems to be pretty characteristic of the Chinese bar at this point.
But a la your comment about technology, wait for that generation to die.
Yeah.
And the technocrats, right. This will be gone.
Yeah.
It's just a matter of waiting 30 years for the old ones to die.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
it's over.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
Some of those church connections are going to get made over the internet and Facebook.
Facebook.
I don't know whether or not people in China will rise up, but we know a lot of Chinese young people who are on, who are our friends on Facebook, or are my friends on Facebook. When they're in China, they are not technically allowed to go on Facebook, even though they know that there are ways to get around it. They don't do that. Mm-hmm. And we last summer, I asked some friends, why don't you go ahead and do that anyway? I mean, my American way would be to say, I'm going to go on Facebook. I don't care what anybody says. It's my right. I'm going to do that.
But or stay off it for them.
Or stay off it. But there are our young friends in China say, it's not worth it.
Yeah.
They don't. The friends that I have who are young, and as you say, you know, maybe the older ones will broaden it, but the young people themselves are saying themselves, it's not a big deal for me. I'm not going to go against the government mandate and go on Facebook because it's just not a big deal. It's not worth it. So that tells me that technology, regardless of technology, the technology is there for people to use Twitter, or people to go on Facebook, or people to start revolutions, but they're not. So there's another reason why they are not.
Well, the Chinese government's created like those Renren and QQ, which are basically the exact same social network, but just that came under by the Chinese government. So that same kind of like wasting time social network does exist. And actually, there are some people who say that the Chinese government actually uses the like Chinese version of Twitter and stuff to be responsive to the people in a different way.
Yeah. You want to respond to that one?
No, not really, but I want to make the point that me fit with this one too. The government and the party really don't care about certain things.
Right.
They don't care what people believe.
Right.
It's not a problem what you believe. And there's this fellow from Hong Kong I know that trusts more than who's in the Williams about the situation in China. He used to talk to a lot of government officials. And the key of it is that several cadres, high-level officials, told him, we don't care what people believe, even what they do. We see it as an administrative problem. It's simply an administrative problem. So to forget the ideology, most of everything else. And if we can handle this administratively and save assholes, some kind of a solution, whether it's penal or negotiated,
Yeah. Well, that I guess that's what I'm trying to suggest by saying that it's a political management problem. That was the administrative problem, is another way of putting it. But then when you switch the vantage point to the person affected by those administrative decisions, that person might look at it and say, well, sure, I am entitled to my beliefs. I carry those up in my head. But when I am motivated to act on those beliefs, and that catches the attention, when I become this kind of administrative problem, then there are going to be restrictions placed on me. But I don't know where those are coming from, right? And that's where the rule of law question comes in. I can't predict that I'm going to have these restrictions placed on me.
That's the anaconda in the chandelier.
Yeah, right.
You have to go party, somewhere in the chandelier there's an anaconda.
Right.
And you don't know where it is.
Right. Yeah. Nice.
Thank you, sir.
Forgot about that. Yeah.
I think part of the reason most people don't care about getting on Facebook is most young people, their lives are so much better than they were 20 years ago. Most young people I know don't really care that much. They don't like their government, they don't trust their government,
right.
But they don't care, and they really don't care about religious rights.
Yeah.
It's just not on the radar at all. It's not like there's a whole group of young people that are fomenting for more religious rights. In fact, they don't trust the government on just about anything except what they said about the Falun Gong. They're sure the Falun Gong is being overthrown.
Yeah.
And so most of them just, on religious rights, they just don't care and aren't going to work very hard at it. And probably lots of other rights, because most of their life, most of them have quite a few rights and live pretty darn well. And are willing to put up with a government that they don't trust or can't understand.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of young people and older people in the United States that maybe fit that same description, right? They don't trust their government, but they and don't really aren't really interested in all those questions about rights. But
you know. I keep thinking about one interesting counterexample, and this is just perspective from the West, and so this is what the Western media wrote about. But Diane and I were at a conference in 2002. Now Diane. Is it properly pronounced Hangzhou?
Hangzhou.
We were in Hangzhou at a conference sponsored by universities to look at the intersection of a Western business ethic with Chinese value systems, and their question was, do we need to get take the religion to get the ethical value system? Well, that was your central question. But interesting occasion. But shortly after we left, the provincial government in Zhejiang province and some of the local officials right in Hangzhou, they decided that the Christians that had kind of grown up as a movement there were getting to be quite troublesome, the political, the administrative problem. And so they decided that they would start to squash some of the growing economic power of the small business entrepreneurs who were Christians in that region. Well, what they didn't realize is that, and they were trying to also kind of pressure the churches to, you know, keep things in bounds. Well, what they didn't realize is that there was a very interesting intersection between the small business entrepreneurs who were members of the Christian churches in growing numbers, who also provided the outreach social services in the region. And so when they started to squash the small business entrepreneurs who were Christians and try to put boundaries on the churches, they started to realize they did not have soup kitchens serving the poor. They did not have access to some basic medical care for the population. And the population across that area started to rise up and get very angry, saying, where are the people who helped us? And within, I don't know how long it took, but it was within a couple of years that the Western media was writing about how the government realized they had not solved the administrative problem. They made it worse, and so they reversed themselves. And they said, you know, we really need this Christian entrepreneurial class that also attends church because they're also providing for the poor, and they help aside solve the administrative problem. I don't know how it's turned since then, but I thought it was a very interesting, and Dan and Diane may know more about what's happened since then.
One of the very strong impressions I had from last summer and then looking at some data since is the extent to which the massive displacement and migration of human beings into cities is, you know, that's really posing a problem now for the government, and the extent to which the government is talking now about civil society, right, as fulfilling a need that the state can't quite handle anymore. And so I've wondered, and this is, you know, speculating into the future, but you wonder if the state has to increasingly rely on religious and other forms of social service provision, does that change the impressions that Kelly was talking about, or others talking about, impressions about religion? Does religion become much more public, but its public face is much more centered on social service provision? But is that ultimately a good thing for religion? Does that have some implications ultimately for how the state addresses religious freedom questions. These are very difficult to sort through, but the social service part of this came up over and over again the whole religion part.
And let's make yours the last question.
Okay, but the difficulty there right now, a lot of Christians are advocating for rule of law for precisely the reason that they have no legal basis to provide medical care, to provide tutoring for the next door kid. And but the problem is, the minute they seek that kind of legal grounding for what they want to do to help others, the government feels like it has egg on its face, because the government is supposed to be the mother, father, nurturer, educator, provider. And so when groups go to the government and say, without saying, they're saying, you're failing to the government leaders. You're not being a good parent to the people, so we're going to have to do it. So why don't you give us a legal basis? Well, by this time, the government feels so insulted that it's not doing its job, that there's a, you know, there's a real problem that we face.
Is that same dynamic happening within the patriotic associations? Because they have social service agencies that they're somewhat associated with them.
And I think the answer here again is, if the government is the one, and this is why I say to my Christians, free Christian friends in China, work with the government. Say to the government, you want to be a good parent to the people. So let's work together through you to provide the services. So that way the government feels that they're the administrative unit behind it. They own it from top down. Mm-hmm. And so I encourage Christian friends to try to work with that, letting the government save its face. But then that's a problem.
Right.
Yeah. So
right.
You get
right.
it.
All right. Well, thank you very much for coming, and thank Kevin once again for doing this.